It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The holidays are upon us, but many may not be supping at sumptuous dinners. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. 2017, 1 in 8 Americans were estimated to be food insecure. That amounted to about 40 million Americans and more than 12 million children. The Maryland Food Bank estimates that 1 in 9 state residents are facing food insecurity. And this morning we have Jennifer Small. She's the Regional Program Director for the Eastern Shore for the organization. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So what has it been, first of all, like in terms of the donations that you're getting, but also the distribution?
Being this spirit of giving this holiday season, we are seeing an influx in donations, whether it be financial and or food. The need is ever growing. Hunger does not take a holiday, but it becomes ever more evident that the need is very present in the community, not only from the amount of individuals that are looking for assistance from the Maryland Food Bank and our partners, but also from the amount of contributions that are coming through our doors.
So what is it? What do we mean when we talk about food insecurity?
So food insecurity is very simple. It's not knowing where your next meal is coming from, let alone where that nutritious meal will be coming from for our families, our children, and our seniors impacted by food insecurity.
So what kind of contributions have you gotten so far?
So typically, individuals are giving in a three-tiered approach. Not only are they donating their time through volunteerism to make sure that there is more food able to go out to service these families, they are donating their talents, whether it be financial contributions. For every $1 contributed to the Maryland Food Bank, we're able to leverage that and provide 3 meals to our families that are food insecure. And then food donations. So many organizations, groups, businesses, even individuals are finding it in their hearts to host food drives and raise food donations so that we can have more food available to those who need it most.
What kind of contribution then do these volunteers make in terms of money, in terms of what their comparable worth is like?
Any individual that volunteers at least an hour's worth of time saves the Maryland Food Bank just over $26 an hour. That's tremendous for a nonprofit organization because those are funds we could save to put to better use to support those programs that are feeding our families.
So what is the general cause then for people who become food insecure? I mean, is it simply financial? What is it that's going on there?
We're seeing so many different things. The face of hunger has really changed over the years. In years past, it used to be that someone who was food insecure was homeless. What we're seeing today is what we term the working poor, the middle class individuals that are working to make ends meet, but for whatever reason, they're not making enough to sustain their monthly responsibilities. They are our children. They are our seniors. 1 in every 6 children, 1 in every 6 seniors here on the Eastern Shore are food insecure. They're having to make choices between do I eat? You know, do I have supplies for school? Do I have prescriptions for those that are in their senior, maybe ailing for health reasons? We're also seeing individuals that have been laid off from the economy, downsizing with particular groups and organizations here on the Eastern Shore. And then, we're seeing individuals that they make just too much to qualify for any type of federal assistance, but in their household, it's not enough to sustain their daily needs.
So, I mean, we get things like the kinds of trade-offs. I mean, I understand. I think it was Hunger in America did a poll talking about that something like 66% of those in this situation that they trade medical care costs off for food or a food offer, say, for instance, utilities, which is about 69%, for example, or even housing. It's something like 57%. How difficult are those decisions that they're making? And what do they tell you about that?
Very difficult decisions. Individuals that are trying to make the decision whether to maintain health insurance or life insurance, as opposed to having those dollars to go to the store and purchase food. Senior citizens who are trying to juggle low incomes already, whether it be Social Security or disability, and then deciding, I still need prescriptions. And those are really viable to their health. So I need to reserve those funds to purchase those prescriptions as opposed to food. Things that we're seeing that they're really having to juggle. And what we see is food is a very basic necessity, but that tends to be the first thing that is actually put off because money is needed elsewhere. University students, community college students are rising in food insecurity percentages because of the fact that they have to reserve their funds for transportation, gas, books, tuition, but they still have to eat. And although we're making strides to make sure they have needs on university campuses, there's still influences that the Maryland Food Bank helps to support so they have access.
So what kind of impact then does this have like on families in terms of how they get, and particularly get along, particularly in terms of the children themselves?
We have a school pantry program that we avail with schools in the 8 counties that we service that have over 50% free and reduced meal percentage rates because we know right then and there is a need within that school system, within that community. We know that if children do not have immediate access to food, their retention rate, their health, their ability to concentrate and excel in school is impacted. We know in a lot of instances, our children have access to free breakfast and lunch. So what do we do after that when these children get out of school? So we also partner with organizations to provide a supper club program so that children can access organizations like the Salvation Army and not only at school have a breakfast and lunch, but after school have access to a hot, nutritious meal. Then the parents are only challenged with trying to figure out how are we going to be able to provide over the weekend, because again, that is very important to their success and their concentration and their level of education. After the school year, the Maryland Food Bank also partners with organizations in these same communities to ensure that now school is not available. They don't have breakfast. They don't have lunch. What happens? So we work with organizations to make sure that every day during the summer, they have access to at least breakfast and lunch. So again, the challenge for the parent is just having to figure out how to sustain them for their supper and over the weekend, which is where a lot of our emergency pantries can fill the gaps. So we realize that not only from the child perspective, but from the family unit all the way up into our senior population, that we have to make more available to fight this need here on the Eastern Shore.
What does it do for a child's own self-image if they have to depend upon, for instance, assistance like that? Whether it's a school, I mean, I don't know whether it's goes unknown as to who gets in, who doesn't in terms of assistance, but even, you know, having that experience.
I would say from our experience, what we're seeing is working through the school pantry program, we're trying to free the stigma so that children are not having to suffer through those image challenges or barriers. And I find that having worked alongside these children very closely, they are so appreciative of the fact that they have something. And so too are their families, because they're not having to worry about the stigma associated with their child showing up with nothing. So at least they're joining their peers during lunchtime, during breakfast time, so that there isn't that question as to why aren't you eating today.
So are there other strategies, I mean, in terms of these families trying to deal with this food insecurity? I mean, I ran across looking at doing some research that, I mean, sometimes, you know, inexpensive, unhealthy foods, for example, and maybe they might pawn property in order to buy food. I mean, what kind of strategies do they use in order to try to make that budget stretch?
As far as strategies, if we look at even just the basic daily routine, a lot of individuals, we see a lot of images in the media. You go to the grocery store and you really are wanting to put those dollars to good use and buy healthy and nutritious foods. they are quite expensive for a lot of the families that are falling through these gaps. So it becomes, do I buy my healthy fruits and vegetables, or do I take the couple dollars that I have and I go through the drive-through for the dollar menu, which I know is going to sustain, it's going to fill our tummies, and it's going to stretch. So those are the things that we are seeing, is we are making worse choices as far as health is concerned, but it's because of the fact that they're stretching those dollars to make sure that that food is available to themselves and to their families.
How much help do they get from, say, friends or families, I mean, particularly this time of year?
I would say the individuals that we come in contact with, the clients that are being served through our emergency partners, they are looking for any and every opportunity. We have had an influx in phone calls at our facility, not only just looking for help, but thinking that we offer financial support because it is the holidays. They're looking for things to make sure that they can fill their shelves. They're looking for opportunities to be able to make sure that there is something nice on the table this Thanksgiving or under the tree this Christmas. So I think what we see is a rise in concern for individuals trying to figure out how they are going to make it through the colder months. We know there is a homeless population that is living outdoors, and that is what they're comfortable with. They don't want to change that. So how do we make sure that they're taken care of and the organizations that we work with are catering to their needs in the outdoors when they don't have regular stoves and heat and things that some of our other families do have? They're just having to juggle if they're going to pay their utility bill this month.
Do you see then a rise in a demand for food particularly during this period of time, or is there a sense that families often will open up their doors at least during the holidays, and maybe then, you know, as you move into January and February, that kind of disappears?
I believe it follows suit with even how our donations work. Hunger does not take a holiday. Everybody is hungry year-round when there is a food insecurity challenge. Individuals are more in the giving spirit during the holiday season. So what we tend to see is more individuals wanting to give financially, wanting to give food donations. And in turn, we also receive a lot more calls as to need. And I think it's because of the colder weather, because that need is still there. It doesn't go away. It just becomes more at the forefront during the holiday season because of the fact that you're targeting things such as lack of transportation. Individuals that don't have transportation, they're not going to be able to sustain their hunger needs. So they do have to reach out to other families, to their neighbors, to their children if they're in the area. And we have a lot of individuals, they don't have family. They're single seniors, for example, that they don't have access. So transportation is tremendous in being able to meet that need. And then you have the health component. In the winter months, a lot of our seniors, a lot of our ill families are not able to travel out in the cold weather.
Now, we often think about food insecurity as it being a big city problem, and particularly and homeless as being a big city problem. But as I understand, food insecurity, for instance, like something like 2.4 million rural households face hunger. I mean, 86% of counties with the highest rates of child food insecurities are in the rural areas, just like this. Is there a difference, you think, between the kind of demands that we see in a rural area as opposed to a big city?
Targeting the Eastern Shore, I would say that numbers tell us 42,000 Eastern Shore residents are food insecure. They do not know where their next meal is coming from. 14,000 of them are children. So that's 1 in 8 individuals, 1 in 6 children, 1 in 6 seniors right here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland that don't know where their next meal is coming from. We service 8 counties here on the Eastern Shore through the Maryland Food Bank Eastern Shore facility. And in those 8 counties, 4 of the top 6 most food insecure counties in the state of Maryland are right here on the Eastern Shore. So if you take the lower end of the Delmarva Peninsula, Dorchester, Wicomico, Somerset, and Worcester, very highly rural areas, they have the greatest food insecurity. Somerset County is the highest food insecurity county here on the shore, with over 19% of the population not knowing where their next meal is coming from. So when we can compare areas such as rural versus city, Baltimore City and Baltimore County are one of the highest food insecure counties in our state. So looking at those types of numbers, I would say there's not a big difference. It's just based on the population size, things like unemployment, and then looking at those other barriers county by county. And even though we look to take a very market regional approach, every county is even very different if you look at different areas. So Somerset, areas that we really need to find support would be areas like Smith Island and Crisfield, because the rest of the county we're able to find partners that have a little bit more capability of servicing the need. But in Crisfield and Smith Island, for example, transportation is a huge barrier. So those become our opportunities that we're constantly challenged with to make sure that we are trying to avail families of every program that we have. And when we can't do that, we need community support. We need organizations to get on board to help us support these families.
Do you find that there is a, I'm not going to say competition, but that the demand, there are only so many dollars. Do cities demand more? I mean, are you in competition with them in some fashion? Or is there just, I mean, because there's just so many resources go around?
I think it comes down to available resources. The Eastern Shore loves to support its own, but there are so many organizations out there trying to support so many initiatives. There are many organizations that are not partners of the Maryland Food Bank, but they're still feeding their communities. We are all applying for the same grant funding to be able to, to provide more resources. So if I were to say anything is competitive, I would just say that it's trying to avail every resource available so that we can all manage the needs that we're trying to serve.
I would assume, by the way, that because, I mean, the incomes, particularly in rural areas, in the shore, I found, and I've certainly found that in the Somerset County, they tend to be, salaries tend to be low, that the income levels tend to be low. How much of an impact does that have then on a community that, I mean, I think a few years back, I think the average income in Somerset County that I ran across was like $21,000-$22,000 a year for like a family of four. I mean, it's just something you can't imagine people surviving on. Now, obviously, there are opportunities, I guess, in terms of tax credits and so on. But, I mean, what kind of impact does that have in terms of people being able to be food secure, especially when you've got a population that doesn't necessarily have a lot of skills, that income level is very low?
It is. And ever more staggering is the fact that about a year ago, United Way of the Lower Eastern Shore put out the ALICE report. And in that report, and it kind of looked at a regional view, but it also looked at a county by county view. It looked at the cost of a meal. It looked at family income. For an individual, just to be able to sustain an average lifestyle, that individual needs to be making around $40,000 a year. That is a pretty difficult charge here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. There are some organizations and businesses, yes, that may be a salary that is able to sustain somebody's well-being and lifestyle. But the norm of that is that it is not. And those are the individuals falling through the gaps. Those are the individuals that are making just a little too much. They don't qualify for things like food stamps. They are having to work two and three jobs if they're able to sustain that. And think of the fact that they're also trying to support their families if they do have a spouse or children. A lot of our families are even supporting their parents. So $40,000 for an individual to support that type of lifestyle, it's not surprising that food is one of those things that is put on the back burner.
How important is our food stamps? We have the agriculture bill that's now moving, I guess, through Congress. It looks as if it's going to go through, and I didn't see any major revisions yet for the food stamp program, at least from what was last year. How important is that in terms of getting people food? I mean, how significant is that?
It's very significant. When we have individuals calling and telling us that they have $30 to purchase food for their family for the month, we have situations like the food stamp challenge. And we have actually tried to eat off of $30 a month. You're not eating very well. You're not eating very much. So it doesn't stretch. With the Maryland Food Bank, we are supplemental. We are as successful at supplying the need with the food donations that come through our door. And because food donations are not as plentiful as they used to be, we are having to purchase probably about 50 to 60% of the food to make sure that there's a well-rounded availability of food to our emergency partners. We work with 194 emergency feeding programs here in the 8 counties we service on the shore. They are other nonprofit organizations, soup kitchens, shelters, school, youth programs. And their goal is to make sure that they are able to provide as much as they can to stretch those needs. So food stamps is very important because of the fact that we're supplemental. We don't always have the well-rounded plate come in through the doors donated. So we purchase things like tuna fish. We purchase things like peanut butter, cereals, those high nutritious items that may not get donated regularly because those are the things that families keep for their families. And, you know, those are circumstances that we need to make sure that we are cognizant of as we move forward, because just because our families need to maintain those items, every family that has to choose between what's going on their table should have access to that as well. And food stamps help them to do that.
But you mentioned, by the way, a $30 figure. What do you get for $30 for a month? I mean, that's a dollar a day, I guess, about thereabouts.
And that goes back to the dollar menu. I mean, we could go through the dollar menu and pretty much for $2 or $3 have a meal that, if you think about it, with what it's furnishing, can probably feed you for the day. Now, it's not going to feed your family, but it'll feed you, the individual. We see, if you're driving around in the communities, you're seeing a lot more individuals outside of stores trying to get money or food because there just isn't anything there. I know when I go to places to get my gas, Wild Rio Farms, I'm usually stopped once or twice at each location. And having worked for the Maryland Food Bank and also being in a very personal situation myself, I want to make sure that they have access. So it's, let's go walk in. Let's get you a cup of coffee. Let's get you a sandwich or a loaf of bread and some bologna, something that's going to really keep you full until tomorrow, because that's all they're looking at right now. They're not looking at next week. They're not looking at next month. They're looking at, how do I get through today? And what does tomorrow look like?
One of the things we don't really think about are our seniors being impacted, but obviously they do. Feeding America estimates something like 63% of seniors are forced to choose between, say, food and medical care. What kind of population are we looking at there? Is that increased? We know that, for instance, the population is aging. We have the grain, obviously, the Eastern Shore. What are you seeing there?
Most of our partners, during their distributions, are seeing about 50 to 60% of their clients served being senior citizens, which means there's more that has to be done. There's not enough. The Maryland Food Bank needs to work with organizations to be able to make sure that we can help. A lot of them are living in low-income subsidized housing areas. They do want to take care of themselves. But something we have noticed is also pride doesn't stand in the way. So they are very apt to not only avail themselves to the needs that they have, but even when they don't have anything, they're also ones that are trying to support the younger generations, which I find very humbling because they themselves are in just as much need as those that they're helping to serve. So we're looking at organizations that can partner with us in a way that we can provide more food to these seniors, because we do realize that just as the university student population need is growing, so too is our senior population.
You mentioned a moment ago that that they often find themselves helping out their kids. What about the reverse? Do you see a lot of reverse, or I mean, what's going on? I mean, or is it the economy so insecure that maybe the kids don't necessarily contribute or contribute as much as perhaps they could?
I think they contribute as much as they can. I think there's a limitation there. When we look at the populations being served, our youth are just as vulnerable as our seniors. I mean, 1 in 6 children, 1 in 6 seniors, and children are measured under the age of 18. They have a tremendous heart for giving back. But again, I think they realize their struggle is very real. And when you're a youth adolescent, someone in your 20s, and you're still living with your family, your priority becomes how are you going to help feed your family, your siblings, et cetera. So again, I think it's more about what's available to them to support and not that they choose not to.
You mentioned a moment ago that this was sort of a personal issue for you. What did you mean by that?
So about 12 years ago, I went through a very bad divorce. I had a 1-year-old son. I had a corporate job, so I was traveling across multiple states, going through a divorce and having a child that really isn't conducive to my son's well-being. So I decided to look for another position. And with my degree, I was able to find something working with adolescent youth in the school system. I gave my notice to the company I was working with, had been with them for almost 10 years, and they were downsizing, so they weren't going to replace my position. They accepted 2 weeks' notice, and into week 3, I get a phone call that the job I was due to be starting no longer had funding support for the county, and I no longer was going to have a position. So here I am, a mother, a single mother. I no longer have my corporate job. I'm no longer going to have a job that's going to help support our finances. My husband at the time had emptied our bank account, so I had no money in the bank. I had one paycheck. That one paycheck was able to afford me first and last month's rent for an apartment. I was able to make a car payment. And then it became, how am I going to support my family when my expenses are $3,000 a month? And that was just daycare, insurance, food, rent, utilities. So in our instance, it became very hard to stretch that dollar. And the dollar store was where we shopped, which is a lot of our family's choices right now. So things like ramen noodles, macaroni and cheese, Vienna sausage, not the healthiest of things,
right,
but a couple dollars really went a long way. And I remember many a time I'd be sitting in the kitchen with my son and he'd be, "Mommy, aren't you hungry?" And I was very hungry, but there wasn't enough. And I would just explain to my son that Mommy wasn't feeling quite right and that I wanted to make sure that I sat there to keep him company, but I just really wasn't very hungry. And I would just drink water, glasses of water, because that was filling, but that's all I could afford. And it was so much more important to make sure that he had something on the table and not have to worry. It took me many months in the state of Virginia, which is where I live, because I had retirement, I had income. So I didn't qualify for any type of food stamp support. My retirement, after the hefty penalty that I had to take for withdrawing, because of course I'm not retirement age, afforded me 4 months. So $14,000, I was able to support myself and my son for 4 months. And all the while, I was knocking on every single door and business that I could. But because my resume had corporate background, they wouldn't take a chance on me because they figured the next great thing that comes along, I was going to leave. And it became a point that I said, I will scrub bathrooms. I will do whatever you need me to do. And it just wasn't enough. So after about 4 months, I was working for an organization. I was at training, still looking for something. And the position with the Maryland Food Bank was posted. And I thought, my gosh, if anybody understands the mission of the Maryland Food Bank, it is absolutely me. And I applied. And after a couple months, I was able to come and work with such a wonderful organization. And I'm going into year 10. So I think there's a greater appreciation from the fact that I was an individual that just by chance fell on very difficult times and had to figure out what to do. So now I work for the organization that helps to improve the end of the line for so many of these families. And I think that's what's so humbling, is the fact that I get to work with these individuals every day. I get to hear their needs and really feel the fact that it is so hard to tell somebody, can you help me? I really need help.
When you talk to these individuals that that come for food, do you see yourself in them?
I do. I see my family. I see my friends. I see my children. You know, when my children go to school and they come home and say, Mommy, there are so many of my friends that don't have anything and I shared my lunch with them. We're not doing enough. We have to do more. And when fathers call and they're in tears, my wife is sick, I'm working two jobs, she can't work, I don't know what to do, I don't have enough money. Nobody should ever have to feel that. So yeah, I think I probably put a little bit of me in that because I know what it feels like. And it is very gut-wrenching and it is very difficult. And when you watch your children and you don't want them to know how bad it really is, that's very difficult, but it's very real because it's all around us.
Do you find it ironic that we live in a country with a tremendous abundance? Our agriculture is probably the most efficient in the world. We export it. And yet we have this disparity in which we have people who are food insecure.
It is. I believe the last numbers was about 40% of the food that we have is wasted. And I'm thinking about how much impact that 40% of food wasted could have on the families that we're trying to serve. Just even a portion of that. I mean, we are very agriculturally rich here on the Eastern Shore. So our Farm to Food Bank program is thriving. We work with farmers to glean produce for our families. We work with farmers who donate what would otherwise get tilled under for waste. We now contract grow with our farmers so that there's available produce year-round as opposed to just seasonally. So we're able to provide so much off the shore that other states may not have the opportunity to. But again, to hear that so much food is wasted when there still is this plight of hunger, I think those are things that we really need to be focusing on.
Well, we've been speaking with Jennifer Small. She is the regional programming director for the Maryland Food Bank here on the Eastern Shore. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
This has been Delmar Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. A set of goals were set up for the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay by 2025. So how are we doing? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The Environmental Protection Agency put the bay on what was called a pollution diet, and it was supposed to keep the states on track in cleaning up the estuary, but it appears that we are falling behind. Recently, Carl Blankenship, editor of the Bay Journal, took an extensive look at the progress and the problems that we still face ahead, and we have him on the line this morning. Welcome to the program. So let me ask you this. So we have this goal of 2025 in terms of a pollution diet getting there. Are we behind the schedule, as it were?
Yes, the region as a whole is behind. The goal was to have achieved 60% of the nutrient reductions that they were supposed to get by 2025. They wanted to get 60% of them by 2017. And although we're on track for phosphorus, we're pretty far behind for nitrogen. Instead of 60%, they only got about 30% of the way there.
Why is it that we're behind on those two?
One is that nitrogen has always been problematic since bay cleanup efforts started. It's always been a difficult nutrient to work with. And then the second part of the answer is that the biggest state for generating nitrogen is Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is really far off track compared to the other states. They have a lot to do by 2025.
Well, why is Pennsylvania so far behind?
Because everyone has had the easiest time reducing nitrogen from wastewater treatment plants, where it's basically upgrading plants and reducing what comes out of a pipe. It's a technological fix. And states with a lot of wastewater treatment plants have generally made a lot of progress towards the goals. Pennsylvania has much less wastewater than the other states. Only about 10% of their nitrogen comes from wastewater. That means, and they have more agriculture and more stormwater than any other state, and both those sectors have been difficult to control, and that adds up that they've been difficult to control for everybody, and so that makes the job worse in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is also, you know, to be fair, has not put as much effort into it as the other states. They don't have the programs. They haven't put the financing into it. And, you know, some would argue that EPA hasn't really exercised as much oversight over Pennsylvania as it could have, and that's caused them to fall far behind where they should be right now.
Because, you know, as I understand it, that the Environmental Protection Agency getting involved, and not only the pollution diet, but just taking over in terms of getting the states to do this, that was supposed to be at least the magic bullet.
Yeah, the EPA was, when they issued the cleanup plan, you know, it's known as the total maximum daily load or the pollution diet, when that was issued in 2010, you know, it was supposed to be more enforceable than, you know, voluntary agreements of the past. But EPA's oversight is fairly limited. You know, they have the most oversight over facilities that actually have a permit. You know, agriculture doesn't, EPA does not have as much authority over agriculture as it does, say, a wastewater treatment plant and to some extent stormwater. And so EPA didn't have as many tools to work with in Pennsylvania. You know, some argued that it could have been more aggressive with its permit oversight. It could have done more enforcement. It could have withheld money. You know, others say, you know, that may have just more discouraged Pennsylvania from doing anything. And so that's a back and forth. But however you make the argument, you know, the simple fact remains that Pennsylvania is significantly behind the eight ball on this effort.
So, I mean, is there something that the EPA, you think, then could have done? I mean, is there a lack of political will? I mean, is it just a domination of, say, the state capital or the whatever it is be, that political entities, that they're just reluctant to put the money in?
In Pennsylvania, if you're talking at the state level, there's been a problem for years where the legislature has been very reluctant to raise any type of fees or make money available for anything, and it's been very difficult to squeeze money out to ramp up Bay efforts, and that's kind of resulted in the Bay putting, or the state putting significantly less money into anything. You know, that there's less money to support farmers in Pennsylvania. You know, in Pennsylvania, a lot of the municipalities were left to upgrade their treatment plants on their own dime, whereas, you know, Maryland and Virginia had state grant programs to help them with the upgrades. And so money has always been a problem in Pennsylvania.
By the way, speaking of Pennsylvania, what kind of contribution does the Conowingo Dam play in all of this? I know in some of the discussions that have taken place down here over some of the environmental issues, some of the farmers have pointed to Conowingo Dam as like the major problem in comparison to themselves. What kind of role does that facility play in terms of pollution?
Well, Conowingo Dam doesn't generate pollution per se because the pollution is coming from upstream. You know, it can affect the timing of when things reach the bay. The issue with Conowingo Dam is the reservoir behind the dam used to trap a portion of the nitrogen and phosphorus coming downstream. But in the last decade or so, that reservoir filled, and instead of trapping a portion of the pollution, basically everything that comes downstream passes the dam. And because of that, you know, when they set the cleanup goals, they didn't realize that was happening. And because they've now figured that out, that means actually even more reductions, nutrient reductions, are needed to offset the impact of the dam.
Is there anything they can do about it? I mean, I know that there are some proposals to somehow figure out what to do about that.
Well, Maryland has tried to force the owner of the dam, Exelon, to pay money to offset that pollution as part of the conditions to get a new license, and that's in court right now, and you know, no one knows how that's going to play out. Meanwhile, the states and EPA have agreed to work on a plan to find a way to offset that additional pollution, and you know that they will be working cooperatively on that, but that's kind of in preliminary stages right now.
Because I think I saw from a few your figures, I think in your piece, was that something like 6 million additional tons of nitrogen into the bay from
pounds.
Yeah, pounds came from the dam, and I think for phosphorus is what 270,000 additional is. So is are we stuck with that contribution, and we just simply offset it somewhere else, or is there something that it can actually be done with the dam to keep maybe lower those figures?
Yeah, there's really not a lot feasible that can be done with the dam. It's a matter of finding additional nutrient reductions upstream or someplace else to offset the impact. Because, like I said, most of the nutrients, they're not being generated by the dam per se. They're stemming from the fact that what the dam once trapped is now passing through, and there's not a lot in the dam operation that can change that.
So what needs to be is, so the action then really needs to be done upstream, which is something that apparently Pennsylvania is behind.
Right. Yeah, because you could do some of the offset by reducing nutrients elsewhere, but the way the bay works, to offset Conowingo, you most efficiently would achieve those nutrient reductions if they're upstream of the dam. You know, reducing them from other places would actually require you to control significantly more than 6 million pounds of nitrogen.
Also, what's the story with Virginia? How are they dealing with this?
Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
How are they dealing with...
With pollution into the bay.
Virginia's doing pretty well, and Virginia benefits in large part because a higher proportion of their nitrogen came from wastewater treatment plants than any other states. And so they had a technological fix that gave them a really good head start. So Virginia furthest along. Well, West Virginia's further along statistically, but Virginia has done really well. Of course, as with other states, in the out years, they have to do more with agriculture and stormwater.
By the way, I just mentioned briefly, New York was also a contributor. One doesn't think of it that way. What's New York's contribution to all of this?
New York's contribution isn't huge, but it's in the Susquehanna River, and so like Pennsylvania, it's contributing to the Susquehanna problem, and New York's always been kind of like a reluctant player in the Bay effort. I think it's safe to say that they view themselves as being far upstream. The part of New York that's in the Bay watershed tends to be economically depressed. And they also have a wastewater treatment plant in Binghamton. It's the largest wastewater treatment plant in New York's portion of the watershed. And there's been problems with upgrades they tried to do at that plant. They didn't really work. And so, unlike the other states that made some wastewater treatment plant gains, that's not happened in New York. And so that there's still a fair amount that New York has to do yet. That's not of the magnitude of Pennsylvania, but it kind of exacerbates the problem that they're both contributing to the Susquehanna River, which comes down, you know, it's obviously the biggest river to the bay. It contributes half the water to the bay.
So turning to Maryland, where we are, how do you assess how the state has approached trying to deal with pollution, whether it's wastewater treatment or obviously here on the Eastern Shore, agriculture and stormwater in particular are the big ticket items?
Yeah, Maryland, I think most people credit Maryland with having some of the best programs to address the nutrient pollution to the bay, you know, for wastewater, stormwater, agriculture all the way around. That said, they have a long ways to go, and that's because of a bunch of little things that add up to them having further to go between now and 2025 than they originally thought. You know, they upgraded the computer models that they use to assess impacts on the bay and progress, and some of those changes increased Maryland's impact on the bay. Part of it's because Maryland is really close to the bay, and so nutrients that come from the eastern and western shores, you know, a higher proportion of those nutrients actually reach the bay than they do from other states. In the new model, nitrogen tends to be a little bit more important relative to phosphorus, and that affects Maryland a bit. The Potomac Basin is a little bit more important to the bay water quality, and that contributes a little bit. But significantly, you know, in recent years, they've done a lot of work to update the data that's used, and that data showed that in Maryland, there's like more fertilizer being applied than they thought, and there's more farm animals. You know, you see, you know, on the Eastern Shore, you see obviously more chicken houses and things, and so, you know, that's meant that some of the nutrient inputs had been underestimated, and so that's added up to make Maryland's job a bit more challenging than they would have thought like a year ago.
By the way, how do you assess the Maryland Phosphorus Management Program? Is that enough? I know it got delayed. There was some critique about whether it went far enough. What sense do you get about that?
My sense is that it has made a bit of a difference. You know, it looks to me, you know, just overall, it looks to me like Maryland is on track to meet its phosphorus goal, and so I think that's not going to be a big problem for them. You know, as long as they keep up the efforts that are underway.
I mean, the big issue, I guess, here in terms of pollution has been nitrogen. And some have suggested, by the way, that the soil itself is so saturated with nitrogen, whether it's from past uses or just that it's inherent in the soil, that it's going to be very difficult to get a reduction in that from leaching into the bay. What sense do you get about where we are and how manageable that is?
Well, you have two problems, especially on the Eastern Shore, that are difficult. You know, it's the phosphorus that's kind of in areas where they apply lots of chicken manure. The phosphorus has really saturated the soils, and that's going to leach out for a long time. Similarly, the nitrogen from decades ago leached down into the groundwater. Groundwater moves really slow on the Eastern Shore. Some of the nitrogen that was applied in the 1960s in some places is only now starting to reach the bay. And so you're right, there's some significant time lags from some of those past activities that are going to take a long time to work through the system.
In terms of the health of the bay, I mean, how do you assess that? We've had a number of assessments. There have been some improvements in, for instance, the underground, underwater grasses, blue crabs, and so on. What are we seeing, do you think, from the bay that indicates that we might be making some progress here?
One of the things, one of the closest indicators that I look at, and a lot of other people do, is underwater grasses, because underwater grasses really respond to water quality, particularly clarity, because they need lots of sunlight to survive, and they're also really important habitats for juvenile crabs and fish and waterfowl, and so it's an important resource. It's got a really tight connection to water quality. And last year, the amount of underwater grasses, you know, went over the 100,000 acre mark, which is the highest it's been in decades and decades. It's about three times where it was in the mid-1980s when cleanup efforts really started. And that's, to me, a clear indication that things have been improving. And there was a scientific paper out this year that made a pretty good case that link to underwater grass recovery was stemming from nutrient reductions over time in the bay. Similarly, if you look at dissolved oxygen levels in the deep portion of the bay, you know, the dead zone, those have slowly improved in the worst places over time, and the dead zone is disappearing earlier at the end of summer than it used to be the case, which is a sign that the algae, you know, the dissolved oxygen levels decline because of algae. The algae, when there's too much algae, it sinks to the bottom of the bay. It's decomposed by bacteria, uses up the oxygen. And when the dead zone breaks up earlier at the end of summer, that means that the amount of nutrients coming into the bay has been reduced, and it's and the amount of algae that's left at the end of summer is less. So there's definitely some signs that what they've been doing has been helping, and if they'd done nothing, the bay would have been considerably worse today than it is.
By the way, how important, in terms of agriculture, how important are the cover crops? I mean, do they do as much as we would like them to do in terms of keeping pollution from the bay?
Yeah, cover crops are a really good way to help the bay because they help absorb the excess nitrogen. And importantly for farmers, you know, a lot of the nutrient reduction actions that farms can take tend to reduce productions or take farmland out of production, and a cover crop doesn't do either of those, so it doesn't reduce your productivity. And in fact, there's evidence that the cover crops, if they get plowed into the ground or are left on the ground at the end, you know, they can actually help the soil health and improve productivity. And so cover crops can be a big benefit.
So the other thing is, you indicate that maybe the good news is that as we move forward, the cleanup could come faster than as you get closer to the goal. What you suggested that in your piece. What do you mean by that?
That is the hope, because there, some of the scientists believe that there's evidence that the dissolved oxygen levels in the worst part of the bay, this gets into a chemical process more complex than we want to describe here, but there's some evidence that oxygen levels in the worst part of the bay have improved better than they would have, or more than they would have predicted, just from nitrogen reductions alone, which is evidence they think that those reductions have allowed a process to kick in where Mother Nature, in a sense, they've given Mother Nature a chance to help to kick in a chemical process that is further improving oxygen conditions in the bay. Similarly, when you get really large underwater grass beds, they tend to improve water quality in the surrounding areas, which allowed those beds to expand even more. And so people talk about this as being a tipping point. When you get to a certain level, you know, Mother Nature kind of helps out by allowing grass beds or oxygen conditions to improve a little bit more than just the nutrient reductions would have produced by themselves. And there's some evidence, there's some reason to believe that's happening.
Are you optimistic that we can get on track to clean up the bay? And do you think we will actually meet those 2025 numbers, or do you think it might be a little further out?
I don't think they can meet. I think few people who look at those numbers seriously think that the 2025 goals can be met by 2025. You know, we can certainly make progress by 2025. I mean, Pennsylvania has certainly ramped up its efforts recently and has taken the obligation more seriously in the past year or so than was the case. You know, I think few people think that Pennsylvania could get to where they need to be by 2025, because the amount that they would have to ramp up is almost impossible. But, you know, certainly as long as everyone keeps doing what they're doing and ramps up efforts, we should have a better bay in 2025 than we do today. One thing, you know, I tell people, yeah, I started writing about the bay in 1990, and back then the cleanup goal was to have everything done by 2000, and I thought in 2000 I'd be looking for another job. You know, since then, you know, I've watched a number of goals be set and missed, and it's easy to become cynical about the effort. But when you take a step back and look at the bay, you know, it's clearly better today than it was in the mid-1980s by almost any measure that you would use. And as long as the cleanup effort continues, you know, I would expect it to continue to improve, you know, even if we don't hit the goals. You know, at the same time, I think it's important for people to realize, you know, we're not going to turn back the clock and have, you know, the bay of the past. You know, there's just more people in the watershed. There's more hardened shorelines. You know, the climate's changing. You know, the bay of the future is going to be different than the bay of the past, you know, regardless of whether we meet the goals. But we can have a better bay than we would otherwise have in the future, you know, as long as we keep working on this long-term effort to reduce nutrients. You know, we are seeing responses, and I would expect that to continue into the future.
Yeah, we've been talking actually about a lot of the local efforts, but what kind of impact do you see in terms of climate change, something that we at the local level, whether it's any of the individual states, I find it very difficult to do anything about unless something happens dramatically. What kind of impact do you think climate change is having on all of this? And does it make it harder?
Yeah. I mean, there's two parts to the answer. One is climate's going to change the bay, you know, physically, because the sea levels are going to be higher. There's going to be eventually fewer marshes around the bay. The bay is going to be warmer. You know, there's going to be a lot of changes in the bay itself. You know, the species makeup's going to change and stuff. In the nutrient equation, it, is expected that it will make nutrient reductions more difficult over time, largely because there's been a long-term trend towards increased precipitation in the watershed, and there's suggestions that there's also increased storm intensity and increased rain, and increasingly severe storms tend to wash more nutrients off the landscape than would otherwise be the case. And so there's reason to think that more nutrients will be coming down in the bay under, you know, with climate change than would otherwise be the case. And so that's going to require more work to offset in the future.
We've been speaking with Carl Blankenship. He is editor of the Bay Journal and taking a look, an extensive look, really, at the problems that lie ahead in terms of cleaning up the bay. I think it's a four-part series on it, so people should check out the website. And Carl, appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.